Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in East County. Today on our Capitol Report, we'll tell you about legislation in Congress aimed at cracking down on sanctuary cities and states, as well as immigrants who repeatedly enter the U.S. illegally. Then on our Education Report, hear about some important court rulings impacting charter schools, including several that are set to shut their doors here in East County. We'll also have the latest twist in a lawsuit against the Grossmont Union High School District and Superintendent Tim Glover, which alleges that district employees manned a phone bank for a ballot measure during school hours, a potential violation of the law. Plaintiffs just got a boost thanks to a ruling in another court case over just what constitutes a public record. On People Power, hear about a valiant sheriff's deputy who long headed up search and rescue efforts in our region, helping to save others. And he's now facing his toughest challenge and getting some help from the community giving back as he battles brain cancer. We also have news about an arson arrest made thanks to a CAL FIRE investigation. Our newsmaker interview today is with Glenn Jensen. He's a technology expert who's running for Congress against Duncan Hunter in the 50th Congressional District. You'll hear his ideas and views on the issues that matter most across our region on today's show. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital.
This is Rebecca Williamson with a Capitol Report. The U.S. House of Representatives has passed two bills aimed at cracking down on undocumented immigrants. The measures punish sanctuary cities and states by withholding key funds, also boosting penalties for certain immigrants who re-enter the U.S. illegally. The bills fulfill part of President Donald Trump's campaign promises, but have drawn a letter of opposition from 400 nonprofit organizations on behalf of immigrants and their families. House Resolution 3003 is titled the No Sanctuary for Criminals Act. The measure would authorize blocking federal grants for law enforcement, anti-terrorist activities, and national security purposes to states or local governments that have policies limiting officials from cooperating with mass deportation efforts by the Trump administration. It isn't limited to serious felons. It would also impact undocumented immigrants who have not committed any crime other than entering the U.S. without documentation. House Resolution 3004 is titled Kate's Law after San Francisco woman Catherine Steinle, who was killed by an undocumented immigrant who had been deported multiple times. It would increase penalties for people who re-enter the U.S. illegally after being deported three or more times, or who have been convicted of certain crimes. Maximum sentences could be up to 25 years in prison. U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions says the bills would end abusive attempts to undermine federal law, adding, Americans demand that these sanctuary cities stop protecting criminals and start protecting law-abiding residents from danger. But the bills have drawn strong opposition from advocates for immigrant families. Christian Ramirez, Human Rights Director for Alliance San Diego, states, having police officers do the work of border agents undermines public trust and threatens public safety for all. Instead of tearing families apart, we should rein in the extraordinary powers of immigration officers who can stop, interrogate, and search children on their way to school and parents on their way to work, all done without a warrant or reasonable suspicion. He called on cities and states to support policies such as Senate Bill 54, the California Values Act, which prevents state and local dollars and law enforcement agencies from helping immigration officials terrorize families, according to Ramirez. The pair of bills now advance to the U.S. Senate. If approved by the Senate, President Trump has indicated he will sign both measures into law.
This is Gene Carpenter with an education report from East County Magazine. Several recent court rulings will impact the future of many charter schools in California, including schools in East County. Last October, a California appellate court ruled that charter schools can't open campuses outside their authorizing district within the same county. That ruling affected a suit filed back in 2015 by the Grossmont Union High School District, which wants to shut down the Julian Charter School, Alpine Academy, and Diego Valley Charter School, all operating within the Grossmont District boundaries. In April, Judge Donald Donnelly ordered all three of these schools to close down by June 30th, but the State Board of Education granted a waiver allowing them to stay open until June of 2018. Donnelly's decision stems from a case against the Julian Union Elementary School District, which has operated charters in both San Diego Unified and Grossmont districts. An effort to save the schools came from four students who filed a request asking to modify Donnelly's decision. The students argued that revoking the charters for their schools would deny their education. But on June 27th, Donnelly denied the students' requests. Charters can generate profits for small financially struggling school districts such as Julian Union and Mountain Empire. The latter became embroiled in scandal after former superintendent Steve Van Zandt pled guilty to a felony conflict of interest for starting up charters supervised by Mountain Empire in other school districts, while pocketing money paid to a consulting firm owned by Van Zandt and his wife. A key argument against charters opening outside their home districts is that they take average daily attendance money from the state and divert those funds away from public schools. Some charters have faced accountability issues, as in La Mesa, where the La Mesa Spring Valley School District recently denied a charter request for College Preparatory Middle School. That school attained strong test scores, but was found to be non-transparent and non-responsive to other serious concerns raised by school board members. But students at some charters have been vocal in support of their schools. Diego Valley Charter, for example, has helped students who had to work to support their families, including many immigrants and refugees, as well as new mothers and students who were too old to attend public school to obtain high school diplomas. They argued that the district's efforts to shut down their school was all about money, not putting students' needs first.
San Diegans for Open Government filed a lawsuit in January against the Grossmont Union High School District and Superintendent Tim Glover. The suit alleges that the defendants intentionally used personal email accounts and text messaging devices such as mobile phones and tablets to communicate about illegal political activity they were conducting without being subject to public scrutiny on Measure BB. That's a school bond measure that was on the November ballot. The watchdog group requested records, including emails and texts sent to or from Superintendent Glover's personal electronic devices regarding the bond measure, but they did not receive all of those records that they sought under the California Public Records Act. Before filing the suit, Attorney Corey Briggs sent a letter to Superintendent Glover stating, "It is believed that you may have engaged in illegal, potentially criminal political activity." The letter contends that Glover may, during working hours, have pressured parents, students, and subordinates to campaign for Measure BB, including working a phone bank at Grossmont Center. Briggs further contended that he has evidence suggesting Glover directed employees to fill in on that phone bank during working hours and spent district money on such political activities. Briggs' letter warned that keeping public records secret, altering or destroying them, is a felony, punishable by up to 4 years in prison. He also asked for expense reports and reimbursements from the district. The district, in its response, denied those allegations. The district claims the records requested are not public records and further argued that it had no control over or access to records on Glover's personal device. Glover, in his response, similarly argued that messages on his personal devices are not public records subject to disclosure. He denied any illegal activity and insisted that his work on Measure BB was as a volunteer on his own time. But he refused to disclose personal email and text message records that could prove or disprove that contention. However, the arguments by Glover and the district in their legal responses made back in January appear to have been undermined by a recent California Supreme Court ruling issued in March. In that landmark decision, in a case involving the city of San Jose, the state's high court ruled that email and text messages sent or received on public officials' private devices are subject to disclosure under the California Public Records Act, which had originally been designed to cover paper documents. The justices found that in applying the California Public Records Act, a court should recognize that in today's environment, not all employment-related activities occur during a conventional workday. or in an employer-maintained environment. The court observed that openness in government is essential to the functioning of a democracy. Now, not all private emails or texts count as public records, only those that relate in a substantive way to conduct of the public's business. That's to protect the privacy of employees as well as the public's right to know. The court rejected arguments by San Jose, similar to Grossmont's claim that the city did not have access to employees' private accounts. The court relied on federal Freedom of Information Act cases, which found that any writing by a public employee conducting public business is considered retained by the agency, and the employees have a duty to disclose such information in response to a public information request. However, to protect employees' privacy, the court also held that an agency may rely on employees to search their own personal files, accounts, and devices, as long as they've been trained to distinguish between personal and public records. That means disclosure is essentially on the honor system, a problematic issue if an employee may be seeking to hide unethical, embarrassing, or illegal actions. The Supreme Court's ruling leaves some unanswered questions, leaving it up to a court of appeal to determine whether the policies for a search of personal accounts in the San Jose case are adequate to meet requirements of the Public Records Act. And that could impact Grossmont as well. San Diegans for Open Government's case against Grossmont has not yet been heard, but the state's high court made clear that agencies such as the Grossmont Union High School District cannot evade disclosure requirements by claiming that all private communications are exempted from disclosure. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is East County Magazine's People Power, profiling local people making a positive difference in our community and our world. This is Gene Carpenter hosting East County Magazine's People Power. Countless families have been reunited with missing loved ones or learned their fate thanks to the tireless efforts of San Diego Sheriff's Search and Rescue Coordinator, Don Parker. Sergeant Parker, who retired in 2015, made a career of helping others, and now the community is pulling together to bring financial help to Sergeant Parker, who was diagnosed in May with brain cancer. The diagnosis came after the man who specialized in finding lost persons began suffering headaches and one day became lost in his own house. His wife, Missy, rushed him to the emergency room where they learned he had glioblastoma. Doctors performed surgery to remove most of the cancerous tumor, but a portion is inoperable. The prognosis for glioblastoma patients is bleak. Missy Parker says the average survival rate after diagnosis is 14 to 16 months, the Union Tribune reports. But Sergeant Parker is used to beating tough odds, and he vowed to fight for his life. He has stated, "I'm not afraid of dying, but I do not want to leave Missy early. I do not want to leave my kids early," Sergeant Parker has stated. A GoFundMe site has been set up to help Don Parker's family. So far, over $42,000 have been raised for the costly treatments, including radiation and chemotherapy. Under Sergeant Parker's leadership, the sheriff's search and rescue team had a 98% success rate in finding missing children and adults, from lost hikers to wandering Alzheimer's patients. One of the rare cases of a missing child who has not been found is Mickey Goodry, Missy's teen son, who disappeared in the Anza Borrego Desert on Thanksgiving weekend back in 2009. The vehicle he was driving was found disabled off-road. While some dismissed the case as a runaway, Sergeant Parker performed exhaustive searches in the desert, tracking down countless leads. He never forgot Mickey through the years, even sending out a computerized image of what Mickey might look like several years later. Facing the heartbreaking loss of her son, Missy fell in love with the search and rescue leader and later married Sergeant Parker, but now she faces the prospect of yet another devastating loss. Parker's efforts have touched the lives of many across San Diego County. Ernie Cohen, a division leader who has volunteered for nearly half a century with the search and rescue team, says of Sergeant Parker, "He has saved lives, changed lives, and brought closure to dozens, perhaps hundreds of families." Among those who found closure, albeit amid tragedy, were the families of murdered teens Chelsea King and Amber DuBois. Sergeant Parker served 25 years with the Sheriff's Department, including working on patrol, in the jails and court, as a training deputy, on the SWAT team, and for his last 8 years heading up search and rescue, where he oversaw a dedicated team of volunteers. Upon his retirement, Sheriff Gore called Sergeant Parker's ability to motivate 240 search and rescue volunteers amazing. Parker was well equipped for rugged search and rescue work at all hours of the day and night. In his spare time, he has long enjoyed rock climbing and skiing, though he also plays classical piano. In a profile article on Sergeant Parker published by the County News Service in 2014, Sergeant Parker praised those loyal volunteers and explained what motivated him and others to choose search and rescue as their calling. "It is a very positive and rewarding experience. I have definitely made some lifelong friends," Sergeant Parker concluded, adding, "Everybody in the world is here for a purpose. Being in SAR allows us to make a positive difference." Now, his family is hoping for a medical miracle, while their friends hope to provide financial help for Don Parker, who has helped so many others in their times of need. You can donate to help the Parker family at GoFundMe's Don Parker vs. Brain Cancer site. You can volunteer to join the Sheriff's Search and Rescue, or SAR, team at sdsheriff.net/SAR.
Cal Fire law enforcement officers have arrested Jose Duran Aguirre, a transient in Escondido, on arson charges. He is accused of recklessly setting fire to forest land with a signaling device, sparking the trail's fire, which charred 3 acres in Escondido. Cal Fire asks that if you witness someone suspicious in the vicinity of a fire, always contact law enforcement. Anyone with information about arson is urged to contact the CAL FIRE Arson Hotline at 1-800-468-4408. That number again, 1-800-468-4408. Callers can remain anonymous, says County Fire Chief Tony Meacham. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in East County. Today, my very special guest is Glenn Jensen. Glenn is one of 6 candidates running against Congressman Duncan Hunter in the 50th Congressional District. He's a Democrat, calls himself a recovering Republican. He is a lifelong resident of the district out here. He graduated from Helix High School, his wife from Santana. His kids all went through the Grossmont Union High School District. He works in professional sales in the information technology space, and he has worked with the staff of Al Gore on telecommunications legislation, among other things. Glenn, welcome to the show.
Hi, Miriam, and thanks so much for inviting me in the hospitality today to be on KNSJ.
Well, you're very welcome. It's our pleasure. So let me start by asking you, what motivated you to run for office, and what do you view as the biggest contrast between yourself and the incumbent, Duncan Hunter?
Well, what really motivated me to take a run at Duncan Hunter was, after the results of the election, it became very obvious to me that we needed to set this country back on track. We need to have a more progressive agenda. But aside from that, I looked at Duncan Hunter as an individual, and I've been in the district my entire life, nearly my entire life, with the exception of my college time. Duncan Hunter Jr., having misappropriated his funds from his campaign under investigation with justice, became obvious to me that he's been enriching himself, but not necessarily helping the district. He hasn't passed any major legislation that's benefited the citizens of our district. But more importantly, it seems to me that it's pretty doggone close to embezzlement when you take campaign funds.
I should add that that is a criminal investigation currently ongoing under the Justice Department, and that he has claimed he did nothing illegal. He did take out a personal loan with his house as collateral to repay $62,000 that he was accused of taking from the campaign money and using for personal expenses such as a vacation in Italy, jewelry, and video games, and various other things.
Right. Thanks, Miriam. And in addition to that, I think the thing that's troubling to me is just seeing his lack of legislative progress. In 8 years of being a congressman, naming a post office box in Ramona doesn't seem like a significant piece of legislation. And then finally, he is a tremendous supporter of President Trump. And while we should all wish for the success of President Trump, the fact is that most of the protections afforded to the citizens of this district are under assault by President Trump. And therefore, Duncan Hunter Jr. supports that. We look at approximately 68,000 citizens in this district that stand to lose health care as a result of the ACHA, which Duncan Hunter Jr. supports.
Yes, he did. He voted for the repeal of the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, and he's on record stating in his town hall in Ramona that he believes health care is not a right, that it's a question of access, but it should not be a right for all Americans. What is your stance on health care? If you could wave your magic wand, what would you do to reform our health care system?
If I could wave my magic wand, I would have essentially Medicare for all. Mm-hmm. And I base that on the simple fact, I base it on two primary fundamental issues that are rippled throughout my campaign positions. And that is, I treat healthcare as a national security issue, and I also treat every issue with respect to fiscal accountability. And so if we look at this, Medicare is a very efficient system. It provides great value to the recipients. It's affordable. And in fact, if you have a pre-existing condition like my son who was born with cystic fibrosis does, you'd be covered under Medicare for All system. And finally, if we look at just the sheer statistical aspects of this, when I have 350 million Americans, I can predict with great accuracy what my healthcare costs are going to be.
Yeah.
And I don't have an inverse business relationship problem with an insurance carrier who would love to do nothing more than maximize their profits and minimize their payouts. So I think that's pretty significant. And so I have a heartfelt connection with healthcare because of the pre-existing condition. But I also, an older American, I also know that my day of needing more healthcare is coming. So.
Yeah. So is healthcare is a personal issue for you because of your own family situation. Glenn, you have told me that national security and what you call budget accountability are two of the important issues for you in this race, if you're elected, that you would address. Can you elaborate on that?
Yes, but let me define what I mean by those things first.
Okay.
National security is not necessarily associated with national defense. National security is the protection of the quality of life and our freedoms across a number of things. So let's look at healthcare. Imagine if we had a pandemic, swine flu, the avian flu, Ebola.
Zika.
That potentially could be a national security issue because you wouldn't have sufficient funding and coverage to take care of Americans. Our quality of life would diminish and it would make us much more vulnerable. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you have to have then, and by the way, that goes for energy. If you don't have a good energy policy, that becomes then a national security issue. If you don't have a good policy about financial security, that becomes a national security issue. If people are losing their homes and the solvency of their investments in business, then growth can never be achieved, the types of things that made this country strong. So those are national security issues.
Right.
They also have to be paid for, and that's what fiscal accountability is all about. It doesn't mean that we have to be austere. It doesn't mean we have to promote an economic system where we contract the investments in our country the way Greece did. What it means is we have to be frugal. We have to make decisions about how we apply those monies, how we maximize the efficiencies of those, and then challenge Americans to take it up a notch. And we can do that. It can be affordable. We can achieve a progressive agenda and pay for it. And I think that's what's been severely lacking in our highly partisan situation in Washington today. So that has to be broken.
Yeah, and we'll go on and talk about some of those issues in a moment. But first, Glenn, I'd like to ask you, when you say that you're a recovering Republican, can you explain to our listeners how long ago this revelation occurred to you, or this transformation occurred, and what prompted it? And are there still some values that you find worth keeping from what one might consider the old line Republican Party that we used to have? And conversely, what are the values of the Democratic Party that you find most appealing?
Sure. Great question. I was raised in a Republican family, and that was back in the day of when Dwight Eisenhower was a president, and then obviously we had some Republican presidents following that. But that was an era where a personal accountability and shared responsibility were fundamental to the Republican Party. It promoted tremendous growth in our country. It promoted a strong and vibrant middle class. There was respect for alternative views and opinions. That changed. That changed about the time Ronald Reagan came into power. And where my epiphany occurred, it occurred in two areas. One was when I was at UC San Diego, I saw then-Governor Ronald Reagan start to cut tuition and investment in education, and specifically in the UC system. And I thought that that was a completely misguided view. Our future relies on good education. That started me on my path. And then the next was when I had my son Nick with cystic fibrosis and saw some of the deficiencies in our healthcare delivery system and how those were being assaulted. And then finally, the real turner after all of those, if those weren't enough, was Iran-Contra. And that was the complete disregard for law, the misappropriations of weapon systems, dealing with covert agents.
Right.
And obviously a bunch of people went to jail on that.
And coming not too many years after Watergate, we might
That's
add,
right.
which was another Republican administration where a lot of people wound up in jail.
That's right. So all of those things caused me to reappraise. I'm still a competitive guy. I still believe in shared responsibility. I still believe in personal accountability.
Yeah, all good things.
All of those American values. I think the Republican Party has lost their way and they've left those values somewhere in the dust.
Okay. Let's go back a moment to financial security and consumer protections and telecom issues. Now, you worked with Al Gore on some telecom issues. Can you tell our listeners what those were?
Yeah, several years ago when Al Gore was working with John Danforth in the Senate Telecommunications Subcommittee of Commerce, I had a very strong interest in promoting access to programming to satellite dish owners. And so I worked with Al Gore's staff on crafting legislation in a bipartisan committee to bring that legislation forward. And the result of that today is that you have programming for small dishes like Dish Network and DirecTV. Oh. By the way, if you wonder how long that process took, it took me nearly 6 years working with his team.
Wow.
So it's a process to get legislation passed.
It is. What do you think about net neutrality?
I am very, very concerned about the revocation of net neutrality. As some of your listeners know, the FCC has basically three members on the panel. Net neutrality will establish winners and losers on the internet, and it will reduce and constrain the free flow of information. As a Democrat or an independent or a Republican, the last thing we want to do is reduce free flow of information. That gives us a tremendous advantage from our personal liberties point of view, from our business opportunities point mm-hmm. of view, and in the world scope of doing business and conducting business on the internet. So
yeah.
I'm strongly opposed to the revocation of net neutrality.
What do you think as a telecommunications expert about the bill that Congressman Hunter just voted for after taking $16,000 or $19,000 from the telecom industry and that President Trump just signed into law, which allows internet companies, if they choose, to sell our browsing history, sell our email addresses to anybody with the money to pay for it?
Well, it's an unconscionable and poorly written piece of legislation. And it strikes right at our, essentially, it's an electronic version that's an assault on our Fourth Amendment rights. I mean, imagine if you could monetize and point cast and sell off your browsing information without, by the way, your consent
right.
to the highest bidder. That is so completely un-American that anybody with a shred of integrity would have voted that measure down.
Yeah, I agree. I think we ought to be able to buy the browsing history of every member of Congress that votes for myself, but I understand they've protected themselves against that one. On another security issue, cybersecurity is huge right now. As a telecommunication expert, I'm wondering how concerned are you about the allegations that we're hearing about Russian hacking or Russian efforts to hack our election? As we're taping this today, we have word that an NSA contractor has been charged with illegally leaking documents to The Intercept, a publication that published information about just how extensive the Russian attempts to hack
election systems in eight states were. They got pretty far along with this, and nobody can really be completely sure that they didn't successfully actually hack into some of these election systems, apparently. And yet, the Trump administration seems more interested in going after leakers who were talking about this than figuring out whether the Russians hacked our election. And of course, there's a special prosecutor now looking into specifically whether Trump or any of his allies or campaign folks may have had ties to this Russian hacking effort or other issues involving Russia.
It should concern all Americans. Cyber security and cyber terrorism are a national security issue. And when we say that it affects, for example, the integrity of our voting system, that's core to our democracy.
Right. What could be a greater threat to our national security than a foreign power potentially changing the outcome of an election?
Yeah, that's right. And sadly, our cybersecurity and cyber professionals have known about weaknesses in our voting systems and the tabulation systems and how things are agglomerated together. And so, you know, this should come as no surprise. It's a wake-up call for most Americans, but people in the cyber business have known about this.
Yeah, I might add, I've won national journalism awards from my reporting on election hacking and election integrity issues. In fact, some of the paperless voting machines that Diebold made that we had in California were decertified as a result of my reporting. Deborah Bowen decided to decertify those machines, and the CEO of Diebold stepped down, and shareholders filed a lawsuit within days of my national coverage on that. And yet, those very same unreliable, hackable machines are still used in several of those so-called swing states.
Well, those special 12 or 13 states that magically flipped over from blue to red.
Yeah, amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, you have to question the veracity and the overall authenticity of that. But even still, let me cite some other things.
Mm-hmm.
For nearly 2 years, the Iranians had been traipsing around the Navy Marine Corps intranet, also known as NGEN, and it took almost 2 years to detect their intrusion into that network. That's right here in San Diego.
Frightening.
It's the largest intranet in the world. I think the other aspect is, if we look recently more at home about cybersecurity and terrorism and it being a national security issue, consider Target when they had their card scanners compromised.
Yeah.
In a matter of a week, they lost $178 million worth of business activity. Their CEO lost his job. The threat is not only external, but it's internal. Again, it's a national security issue. And by the way, we can ill afford not to make those investments, so there's a fiscal accountability issue associated with this as well.
Yeah, very important. Another security issue, of course, has to do with border security and, related to that, immigration. What are your views about those issues?
Well, let me just state right up front, the building of a physical wall makes zero sense to me when we have so many other things that we need to do, and it doesn't make any sense anyway. And Duncan Hunter, my adversary, obviously thinks that that's a great idea. We already have in place electronic surveillance and countermeasure issues.
True.
That can allow us to detect any intrusion into our border. We also are implementing military-grade biometrics at the borders to sample fingerprints and other types of biometric elements.
Yeah, iris screeners.
Correct, to promote commerce, because obviously you want to have that relationship with your border partners, whether it's in Mexico or Canada, it doesn't matter. And finally, we have shown that immigration reform is completely possible. Ronald Reagan did it previously, and a whole generation of lawful citizens went on to be productive members of our society. So I think what we need to do is be very serious about immigration reform, getting people out of the shadows, protecting those children that are U.S. citizens by the Constitution, and not breaking up families. After all, if we truly are about family values, then it's important that we get immigration reform done today.
Yeah, the stories we're seeing about Trump's immigration reform, as he calls it, are really heartbreaking in some cases. He said he's going after the bad hombres and the criminals, but we're finding that a lot of the people being deported have committed no crime at all other than coming here undocumented 20, 30 years ago. Some of them have children now, young children who are U.S. citizens, and they're being ripped apart from the parents. One guy in Hawaii who'd been here years and years, he's got a coffee plantation, his kids are all citizens, and yet he's just been deported. So it is a very, very troubling issue, I think, for a lot of people. You've mentioned business regulations as something, as a businessman yourself, that you're concerned with. Tell us about that.
So as a business person, we constantly wrestle with having an opportunity to go out and practice our craft and sell our goods and services. But we also have regulations that sometimes are onerous. So one of the things that I would like to make sure of in Washington is to take a look at not just the complaint that there are too many regulations. My challenge to Republicans and independents and Democrats for that matter is, if you're bothered by regulations, tell us what the regulation is that bothers you and why it affects you negatively and how it's not promoting business.
Yeah.
And we'll get rid of that regulation.
Very common sense approach.
Very common sense approach. And then we'll keep the protections in place so there is remedy when somebody steps over the line or rips you off or, challenges your business or damages your family. So the reason why regulations are put into place is for the latter. It's for the remedy. But sometimes the remedy may go too far. And so we should have an honest conversation about those things that have gone too far.
Yeah, we're seeing this administration wanting to completely roll back and even eliminate entire agencies, such as the Environmental Protection Agency, or at least gutting a lot of the protections that were put in place, believe it or not, under Richard Nixon, a Republican.
Right.
He created the EPA at a time when the rivers were catching fire and the air was so polluted that we had smog alerts and you couldn't even go outdoors.
You couldn't see the San Gabriel Mountains when you were standing in Burbank. That's how bad it was.
Right.
And I remember those days as a native Californian. Actually, I'm a fourth generation Californian. Mm-hmm. And I think to your point, Miriam, big energy, big oil, big polluters would love to privatize their profits and socialize their costs, their direct and indirect costs. And my formal education is in economics, so I think in this abstract, and that is that air pollution or that water pollution or Lake Erie catching on fire that you just alluded to cost billions of dollars to correct. Those big energy companies did not pay that environmental impact.
Right.
That is why you have to have certain remedy in place, to assign the cost to the perpetrator of the problem.
Right. When we talk about rolling back regulations, I don't think most of us want to see clean air regulations rolled back to the point, or clean water to the point that
right.
we can go back to letting people dump any chemical that an industry wants to into the public waterways. What are your views about climate change? Donald Trump has just announced he's going to pull the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Change Accord, which every country on earth signed, with the exception of Syria, which is in the midst of a civil war, and one other country that didn't think the regulations went far enough. What are your views on that?
I'm a huge believer of science, and I think the empirical data, the observed data in front of us, shows us very, very clearly that humans have impacted this world. And we're seeing massive reductions in ice pack. We're seeing the rising sea levels. We're seeing the dying of the coral reefs. We're seeing the Amazon Delta, and on and on and on.
Yeah.
It's pretty obvious to me that we have to do something. We have to do something quickly. Let's take a look at where some of that science came from. It came right here, UC San Diego and Scripps Institute of Oceanography.
Yes, two of the finest scientific institutions on the planet are right here with the top experts on climate change. We've interviewed a couple of them on our show.
Yeah, you bet. I mean, they discovered the hole in the ozone that, led to increases in cancer and other things.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the data is pretty clear. Now, the bigger question is, what do we do with it and what are the consequences? I talked a second ago about the indirect costs of climate change and impact. If you consider that 30 or 40 years from now, much of Florida may be underwater.
Parts of Coronado and San Diego, too.
That's right. 80% of the world's population lives within a mile of the coast. So the implications to humanity are huge. In this country, it becomes then, once again, a national security issue and a financial accountability issue.
Right. Now, I know that you've said you're a supporter of clean energy in general, and I think most of us would love to see more solar, less oil, if there was a way to do that and make it economical. That said, here in East County, there have been some projects where we actually saw some negative environmental and health consequences. I'm thinking in particular of a couple of the giant wind energy projects where the wind turbines are as tall as a 50-story building, and they put 100 of them up right around houses or sensitive lands, for wildlife and so forth. So there were issues with noise and flashing lights and infrasound and even Dust Bowl kind of situation, some scraping off the desert topsoil. Do you believe that communities should have some choice? Obviously, everybody, most of us, I think, would say we need to use less fossil fuel, but should communities have a say-so if they don't want a wind farm, but they would rather get the power from, say, subsidizing a bunch of rooftop solar or something? Do you think that there should be ways in these big federal agreements, these big proposals for projects on public lands, for example, that require the utility companies that are proposing them to consider options other than big wind project here or big wind project a mile away, which seems to be the way it's structured right now?
Well, any land use project should have open discourse and an honest, authentic discussion with the residents of that area. And so what we've seen in the past with some of these projects that you referred to, Miriam, is there have been, obviously tremendous politics and incentives associated with those politics. And that's probably not going to change in any energy policy in a nascent market, a market that they're just trying to evolve. Conversely, let's look at a country like Denmark, who now generates they no longer provide incentives for energy, alternative energies, because they generate all their energy from alternative wind power. It just so happens to be located over the ocean.
Yeah.
So the environmental impact was understood. They're also experimenting with, tidal type electrical generation systems.
Right.
And so
it's
on.
Not that wind is bad. It's, right. It's about where do you put it.
Right. So if I were looking, in Congress, one of the areas I would really like to be active in is in the areas of alternative energy and energy independence. I would say let's take a very serious look at our land use regulations and apply incentives to builders that can more efficiently build houses with solar and other types of systems. And again, we don't know what's going to come out. I know IBM, for example, has been working with window pane systems that are actually solar photovoltaic window systems that also use nanotubes. So
yeah, really
the future
exciting.
Is really bright. We just have to, provide the right kinds of incentives and allow the public to interact.
Yeah, there's so much exciting stuff coming down the pike on the alternative energy. I would like to talk for a moment about wildfires, something that's maybe one of the most frightening security issues for almost everyone in East County, at least in our rural areas, who remember the 2003 and 2007 firestorms out here. Glenn, I want to ask if you believe that there's more that the federal government could or should be doing on that, and I'd also like you to share with our listeners your personal story of your own experience during the Cedar Fire.
Yes, thanks. I absolutely believe that the federal government should play a bigger role. This, again, is a national security issue. In our particular case, it's regionalized, but there are other areas of the country that have also experienced an increase in wildfires, perhaps a direct result of climate change. In this particular case, in 2003, during that fire, I live in Blossom Valley, and I literally stayed and fought the fire with three of my additional neighbors. We saved all but one house on the street, and we fought it with garden hoses.
Wow.
And whirlybirds and innovation.
So there just wasn't enough firefighting.
There weren't any resources. And it's even worse, right? Yeah. As a ham radio operator, even though comms were down, I was able to get through the CDF, but we couldn't get any hoses. We couldn't get any hoses because we lacked the training. So, but we stayed and we fought the fires and we saved the house, but everything else went. Had we stopped those fires in Blossom Valley, Harbison Canyon would have never happened. You know, this represents hundreds of millions of dollars worth of damage. So we as citizens need to take some ownership in this. We as politicians need to make sure that we champion things that directly affect our district. That's what a congressman does.
Would you have town halls on a regular basis to hear from constituents who might have bright ideas like what you've just suggested that they'd never know about if they don't get out regularly and do that?
There's no question I would have town halls, and they would be open and available for everyone, whether they were, you know, people that had differences of opinion with me or not. And here's the reason why. A congressman works for us. We don't work for him.
Yeah.
So if I work for you, I need to pay attention to what you, the customer or the voter or the constituent or my friend or my neighbor or my relative, is interested in. If I don't even do that bare minimum, you should fire me.
Mm-hmm.
And therein lies the conundrum with Duncan Hunter. He's afraid of his constituents. because he doesn't care about them. If he did, he would open his doors and you know,
yeah, he did
take
have
the
a,
input.
A town hall, but it was a very small venue in Ramona.
Correct.
A lot of shouting even there, but it was yeah. a venue that was owned by one of his friends in the Tea Party. And unlike, say, Susan Davis, who held it at, right. at San Diego State University, and you could fit 1,000 people or so in there.
Every time the congressman is home, every time I would be home, there would be a town hall. You know, it's okay. real simple. You could have East County Performing Arts Center, for that matter.
There
it
you go.
It would be very simple.
It's about to reopen, and it holds
right.
1,100 people.
You
so
bet.
There you go. You heard it first here on East County Magazine Show on KNSJ. A couple of more questions, Glenn. You've had kids who've gone through the public schools. You're a product of public schools yourself, all the way from, you know, grade school up through college, university. What are your views about education and especially what we're seeing happen right now with Betsy DeVos as the education secretary under President Trump?
So as I look at the secretary, her big push is to promote the notion of vouchers under the auspices of choice. And again, I cited that I was a degreed economist. Vouchers establish a price floor, which means they basically are a subsidy to anybody who's going to a private school, because nobody else can afford to go anywhere else. Let's call it what it is. It's a big lie. Now, as far as public schools are concerned, if we're to have the best educated, most highly qualified and trained workforce to address the needs of the new economy, we have to make those investments. And that doesn't necessarily mean college. It can be vocational schools at all as well. And so, yes, I'm living proof. I went to public schools all the way through University of California. UCSD is the world's 17th best university,
mm-hmm.
and I've made a very, very good lifestyle for my family, but I've also put thousands of people to work for the companies I've worked for from the types of business innovation that I've done or been involved in. So I think this is a national security issue with regard to our fiscal security, with regard to fiscal accountability. This can all be paid for. Completely, because more productive workers with higher value work product pay higher taxes. Even with tax cuts, they pay higher taxes. It's all completely affordable. And then finally, we can also have a civilian bill, much like the GI Bill, where if you receive college tuition or vocational school training or as an elder worker retraining, you give back. You give back to the community you live in. So it's a win all the way around.
Yeah. I love the idea of the elder worker retraining, because there's such a big problem now with folks that are in their 50s
yes.
or 60s, lose a job for whatever reason,
yes.
company moves out of state or closes, and all of a sudden you're not employable unless you want to go be a greeter at Walmart. There's not a lot of,
right.
at Walmart, there's not a lot of opportunities for someone in that age bracket all too often. I'd like to ask you about what we would consider some of the core Democratic values. We've talked about some of those longtime Republican values and values that maybe appeal to everybody. But what about the attacks, for lack of a better word, that we're seeing right now on long-fought wins in civil rights, in women's rights? We're seeing the Trump administration actually eliminating section of the Justice Department that goes after civil rights violations. We're seeing rollbacks in things like birth control access for women. Glenn, where do you stand on those issues? And I should include gay rights as well.
So for any of us that are paying attention to how far things have come in just a short period of time, we realize that there's been a reactionary shift to the right, and it is breathtaking. As you point out, things like, you know, it could be Planned Parenthood, it could be gay rights, it could be any types of minority rights for that matter. Those are clearly under assault. For whatever reason, I have no clue other than the reactionary right or the alt-right influence on this administration, which, by the way, let me set the equal signs. Duncan Hunter Jr. is equal to Donald Trump. Let's make that very clear. The constituents in this district have got to know that if you have an interest in protecting your minority interests, whether you're gay, straight, or a different type of religious experience, those are under assault by this congressman because he supports Donald Trump. Conversely, I believe in liberty. And so liberty says that we expand your freedoms
mm-hmm.
as long as your rights don't overlap my rights, That's the protection afforded under the Constitution. As long as you, you know, you can do whatever you want with your body. You can do whatever you want with your house as long as it doesn't
interfere with your gun or whatever.
Right. Mm-hmm. I have no issue with any of that, but there is a responsibility as well that goes with those rights. And for some reason, many of these alt-right people are more than happy to compromise my rights for what they perceive as the only correct approach. That is, defies liberty. It defies what America is all about. We're expanding liberty, not contracting it. And that's what I will do as a congressman.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for sharing that with us, Glenn. We would be remiss not to talk about foreign policy and terrorism that we're seeing really on the rise around the world, despite the U.S. being involved in two long, hard-fought wars in Iraq, in Afghanistan, more and more involvement in places like Syria, through multiple administrations, I might add, not just the Obama administration, but the Bush administration before, and now the Trump administration. And yet we're still seeing things like the London Bridge attack that occurred recently, the horrific slaughter of civilians that's going on right now in Mosul, in Iraq, where ISIS is using children as human shields, according to UNICEF. Do you have any ideas for where we go with this? What changes, if any, in the course of U.S. foreign policy would you want to see?
It's a very challenging situation because terrorism is essentially an asymmetric warfare act against civilians. And so they only have to get it right every so often. We have to be 100% in terms of stopping those activities. Where I think we're going wrong is that we're addressing terrorism as though it, I mean, maybe with the exception of ISIS, but there are other organizations, as though it is a traditional uniformed army. And it isn't. It is, so it, what it requires us to do, and this changed tremendously under the Bush administration, is it requires us to have embedded covert ops. And when we had those in the past, we were able to defuse situations before they became big situations. We didn't see things like, so for example, we knew about Al-Qaeda. We had embedded people in Al-Qaeda.
Yeah. Interesting.
So the Israelis as well, with, they've shown time and again that yes, they deal with terrorism and there are asymmetric actions that happen against them on their soil, but they're pretty effective because they are embedded. And much of our intelligence information comes through the Mossad and other organizations like that. Now, with regard to human tragedies like you're talking about, for example, in Syria, we dealt with the Bosnian situation quite differently than we did here. We took it as a genocide situation. In fact,
yeah.
I believe that we lost a total of 5 U.S. troops in Bosnia.
That was it. Wow.
That was it. And they were not from combat-related operations. So it was a very effective approach. And we'll probably have to bring General Wesley Clark back to figure out how he did it. But the simple fact is that this is not just a U.S. against terrorism problem in Syria or anywhere else in the Middle East. It is, we have to look at the systemic reasons. Did we have, did we expand our interests in oil in that region? Did we destabilize several political factions within country? Did we lack the intelligence resources on the ground, which I contend that we did? So those are things that I would absolutely champion, is to say, first things first, I think we have to improve our intelligence in country and get embedded so we can thwart some of these things like we saw in Manchester recently.
So that we don't have more terror attacks in this country like what we saw at the Boston
Marathon.
Or
what we saw in Paris. And mm-hmm. and again, these are horrific situations. There are other things too, though. I think that we should not take our eye off the ball of the potential of domestic terrorism. And that is, you know, the biggest terrorist before 9/11 was a U.S. citizen Timothy McVeigh.
The Oklahoma City bombing, where he took down a building with he was a right-wing homegrown extremist.
Right. Absolutely. And so those are things that we really have to take a good close look as well. And that requires raw intelligence in country as well. And the big challenge there is, how do we protect your civil rights while we're doing it? And so things like the Patriot Act have been considered very onerous legislation, and I would consider it as well.
Yeah.
There's no probable cause for their surveillance. But if I looked at this, Miriam, and I said, well, how do we deal with domestic terrorism? Getting embedded in alt-right groups would seem like the right immediate thing to do especially if there's provocation for it.
All right. I've asked all of the candidates that we've interviewed so far, we've had three or four of them on the show so far, of the crowded and growing field there wanting to take on Duncan Hunter for this seat. What makes you think that you are tough enough to not only beat out five or six Democratic challengers, Hunter himself or whoever's the Republicans put up, if he's indicted by then perhaps or out of office, and if you are elected, to stand up to the pressures of the lobbyists and all of that corporate money that so often seems to pollute and subvert democracy? You know, we've seen this over and over, whether it was Randy Duke Cunningham or others.
I think it's a reasonable question. It should be asked of every candidate in every race across the nation.
Yeah, good idea.
No, it should be asked of every candidate in every race across the nation. Now, as far as my toughness against my fellow candidates and against Duncan Hunter, number one, I'm not a career politician. This is a passion with me. This is not about a career position in Washington. This is about making a change and benefiting the constituents of my district in District 50. Number two, I play in the rough and tumble world of information technology in the defense community where the rules are defined, but you have to create coalitions, sometimes natural coalitions that are of a cooperation nature. That is very much like you have to do in a political realm. Number three, I am fearless. So when it comes to a lobbyist trying to buy me, I can't be bought. Number one, I'm not going to be influenced by power. But number two, I have worked with some of the toughest people in business that you can imagine. So I look at some of these guys as almost cream puffs. And so my hope is to bring a sort of mature firebrand approach to how we address the needs of our district, number one, and then number two of our nation as a whole.
I like that term, mature firebrand. That's catching. Good one. Listeners, if you've just tuned in, we have been speaking with Glenn Jensen, who is one of the Democratic candidates running in the 50th congressional seat for the seat that's currently occupied by Congressman Duncan Hunter, a Republican. Glenn, if people want to learn more about your candidacy, where can they go to find out?
Thank you. Thank you so much, Miriam, for the time with your listeners today. And I would welcome people to come take a look at my website. It's very complete. We talk about issues that we've talked about on the show today at votejensen.com.
J-E-N-S-E-N?
Correct. V-O-T-E-J-E-N-S-E-N.com. Easy to find on a web search. And then /issues. And I'm really, really interested in listener feedback. Because remember, I work for you, not the other way around.
Glenn, I'm going to give you the final word today. Is there anything else that you would like our listeners to know on KNSJ about yourself or your candidacy for the 50th Congressional District?
I just want to recap that I am a lifelong Congressional District 50 resident. I share the district with my friends and my family, my neighbors, and people that I care about. I can't be bought. I'm very concerned about the ethics and the tone in Washington. Clearly, I will be that mature firebrand that we just joked about. But I also, at the end of the day, I work for you, not the other way around. We will have town halls, and I look forward to meeting with all of you.
Very good. Well, Glenn, I want to thank you very much for joining us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice.
You're listening to KNSJ, 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Liz Alper, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jules, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.